Okay, so first question. Okay, so why didn't Bruno versus Hulk Hogan ever happen? Is there any specific reason for that?
Well, the one time, when I came back after the, when I came back as a color commentator for Vince McMahon Jr.
Yes.
Back in September 1974, he asked me to put on the tights. It was in the beginning of 1985. And at the time, of course, I didn't want to anymore because I had a long career and I was retired and I was just doing the color commentating. But anyway, long story is that he asked me if I would please put on the tights because Boston was down attendance-wise and a couple other places, and he thought that maybe I could help out. So, okay, so I did. I hadn't wrestled in years, like 3-4 years, and I put on the tights. By the way, during this time, Hulk Hogan was the world champion. And it was pretty pathetic that McMahon was asking an old man, I was about 52 years old, to try to see if I could give a boost to those clubs. So anyway, I started wrestling. I wrestled different places. I wrestled in Boston, Madison Square Garden, Philadelphia, Washington, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, and out some other places too. I went as far as Phoenix, Arizona, Tucson, and Jacksonville, Mississippi. We went to Albuquerque, New Mexico. All these things were way after I'd retired for a number of years. So then I saw that I was booked with Hulk Hogan. I believe it was in Wheeling. It's a convention center in Wheeling, West Virginia. And it was never explained to me, but he canceled out, and they had Sergeant Slaughter took his place. And there was a second time, I'm not sure where it was, where again I was going to wrestle him, and again Sergeant Slaughter took his place. So in reality, then, the match never came off.
Wow. Okay. That's interesting. Okay. So thank you for that. I've got another question for you. Now, you've wrestled all over the world, and in addition to the World Wrestling Federation or the World Wrestling Entertainment, you've also done some time in Japan. And I was wondering if you had any preference over the experience of wrestling here for the biggest promotion in the world or over there in Japan, if you had any personal preference.
Well, not really, because in Japan, of course, it was a little more difficult. You're wrestling nothing but Japanese wrestlers. They didn't speak English, you didn't speak Japanese. And you wanted to have as good a match as you possibly could give to the fans there. Over here, on the other hand, in Australia was easier, because in Australia, a lot of the wrestlers came from here and Canada, and there were some from England and what have you. But it was a little different. But the Japanese were very disciplined. The way they were trained and so forth, when they went in the ring, they were very aggressive and they were very solid. I did like that part about Japan. Mm-hmm. But South America, it was different. I mean, they were all kind of different in a lot of different places. But if you ask me which I enjoyed the most, it was here. I'll tell you why. Because when you get to wrestle people like Kowalski, Domino Jonathan, Ray Stevens, Ivan Koloff, Toru Tanaka, these guys, in my opinion, were among the tops, especially if considering like Jonathan, for example, Big Bill Miller, big these guys were. Mm-hmm. And yet you could go in there and have a great match with them. Mm-hmm. So it was different everywhere, but I'd say the best matches I've had, at least in my opinion, we're right here in the States.
Okay. Now, hello? Uh-oh. Hello?
Yes?
Oh, okay, sorry. Okay, now you mentioned Toru Tanaka. Now he is he had some success here, obviously, as a tag team champion with Mr. Fuji, and over there in Japan as well. Now he also did a number of motion pictures. I was wondering if you yourself had ever courted the idea of crossing over to motion pictures or television, and if so, if you had turned down any specific roles, or if there were any parts you were approached about that you had shown any interest in, or maybe you weren't interested in.
Yeah, no, I was trying to be honest with you. Not that, don't get me wrong, not that I had a lot of offers mm-hmm. for movies, but I was never really interested in that.
Okay.
Did I participate in any? Yeah, I did a few, like the one with some of the other wrestlers, Roddy Piper, and.
Oh, yeah.
Called the Body Slam. Mm-hmm. We shot that in California. Mm-hmm. I had another huge part by any means, but I had a part in there. Mm-hmm. I did one for Robert De Niro in New York called Tribeca.
Mm-hmm.
I did that. And then I did one here we shot called the Saloonatics. But to be perfectly honest with you, I was never interested. Not that I had the offers. This, again, I repeat, so don't misunderstand.
Sure.
But I never had the interest to want to. If the opportunity presented, I wouldn't want to have done that full time. I just didn't like it.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, so here's another question for you. Now, can you think of some guys back from the heyday, from your day in wrestling, that if we brought them into the modern era, can you think of any guys you think would succeed just as well today as they were in your day? Like, if any of the big stars from back in your day, if they would translate over to the modern times, can you think of any guys like that?
You know what? My part, that's pretty hard for me to answer that in a sense that it was different. It was so totally different. In my day, at least during my period, the years that I was in it, we were, I guess you'd consider us more mat wrestlers.
Mm-hmm.
We did a combination of wrestling. For example, if I wrestled a guy, like if you remember the name Hans Mortier, when I wrestled him, it was strictly a wrestling match, and I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
If you wrestled Kowalski, it was more rough. If you wrestled Ray Stevens, I loved it because I think Ray Stevens was great in what we call a lot of high spots and action like that.
Mm-hmm.
Koloff, for a big guy, not in height, but in weight, he was 300 pounds, but yet he moved so well for a guy that size, and he could do it all. He would do a lot of quick, what we call high spot, and good some wrestling, and some brawling. A combination of all these. Now, as far as like today, don't misunderstand. Today, it's different in this sense. Like, for example, I see some of the fellas today, they do acrobatic moves that are absolutely impressive.
Yeah.
I mean, I see guys that do it. Sometimes on a triple somersault going over the top rope and outside the
mm-hmm.
ring, and
mm-hmm.
then a couple of other guys and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that. There's an awful lot of that, but what there isn't, what's changed, they go at a fast pace, which is, I think, fun for the audience. But I don't see a lot of psychology in their matches to where, for example, if they had to depend on the arena like we did.
Yeah.
Remember, in my day, we had no pay-per-view.
Right.
There was no merchandising. There was no big contracts from television station. In fact, to be on TV, the most promoters used to have to pay the station X amount of dollars a week to be on the air.
Mm-hmm.
So we depended on the arena. Television was a means of advertising for the arena. Like, for example, in my own case, for those years, I had the belt for a little bit under 12 years.
Yeah.
All those years, I would appear on TV, but I wouldn't wrestle much. We kept that for the arena. But I would come on TV, usually make some interviews about my upcoming match, say with Kent Patera, or with Killer Kowalski, or Ivan Koloff, or whoever it may have been, George Steele.
Mm-hmm.
But that, again, depending always on the arena. And the way it was back then, if the matches were exciting enough, or we made it exciting enough, to where people would come back for a return match. Today, I think that they do so much on television. All the top guys, they wrestle each other. That I don't see it anymore where they are trying to keep the arena. In other words, they don't depend on the arena like we did in our day. So we had to wrestle different style, more or less, to give the people a reason to come back month after month after month after month at the same spot.
Yes.
Today they don't do that. Of course, they may come to Pittsburgh once or twice a year, or Philadelphia, or California, wherever they go. But you don't see them go any place on a regular basis, like on a monthly basis. They can afford to do that because, for one thing, there are no more territories. They have the whole world, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can afford to hit the major cities a couple of times a year. And then with the merchandising and the pay-per-views and all that, no doubt these guys make a lot more money than we did in our day.
Okay. Well, that's a great answer. Okay. Now, you mentioned about the ring psychology and playing off the arena. Can you think of any stars of today that you think might have fit into that style that you worked with back then as far as ring psychology and working with the crowd, like a star from today that you think would have, if you could go back in time, you think he'd succeed in your arena?
I don't doubt that some of them could be trained into that kind of wrestling and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But as I see it today, the way it is, I don't see that right now, no.
Okay.
I mean, to mention any individual, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of good talent out there. I'm by no means am I suggesting that the talent isn't good or anything, but they've been trained in a completely different way. They weren't trained that kind of style wrestling that we did with, because we depended so much on the clubs. Now they're trained to do extra stuff and to television because they depend on the TV ratings, because I imagine, I don't know, but I imagine that's what makes the contracts when they get renewed to be better and better financially, because everything is the ratings, and of course you get sponsors that pay more and more when the ratings are better and better. So they're trained more for that quick ring action, like I say, these acrobatic stuff that they do, which is extremely impressive. But when, you can do that and go to an arena, whether it be Madison Square Garden or any place, and every week come back and do that without giving people just cause or reason in the fans' mind why they want to come back next week or next month and the following month and the following month and the following month. It's just right now won't work with the style that they use.
Okay.
I don't know if I'm making any sense.
No, you're no. Sure, no, I completely understand. Thank you. Now, you again, back to the arenas and the psychology and all that. Now, I was watching some video of your match with Ivan Koloff, where you lost the title to Ivan Koloff, and where the video wasn't all that great, unfortunately, but the as the legend goes, you could hear a pin drop. It was the whole arena went kind of silent. What's going through your mind in a moment like that? Like, how do you react to that when, after such a big loss, and just that sort of reaction from the fans? Like, what's going through your head?
Well, first of all, if you know the whole story, what that was, that I'd had that belt for almost 8 years,
mm-hmm.
and I was hurting very badly, because you have to understand that. In those days, I would wrestle 2 weeks out of the month. I would go 7 days a week, a and the other 2 weeks I would go 6 days a week. The reason for 7 days is that every second week I would go back for Frank Tammy at the Maple Leaf Garden in Toronto, because Frank Tammy had been very good to me when I went to Canada back around 1961, I guess it was, and he gave me an opportunity, and it worked out real well for me. And so when I got a chance at in New York, you know, with Rogers and that, Frank asked me if I would come in for him, and I couldn't say no to the man, because I respected him and I appreciated that he gave me the opportunity. So the other thing was that we had those boxing rings, and those boxing rings were, I don't think I'm exaggerating, they were like concrete, like they would have steel posts underneath them, because they had to be very solid, because for boxing, you know, you don't want any give on those mats, because they could throw you off balance, I guess. And the mats on top were rather thin. We had no mats outside the ring. They were strictly concrete floors. So when you wrestle under those conditions 7 days and 6 days a week for almost 8 straight years, believe you me, it takes a tremendous toll on the body. I told McMahon I felt like I was cheating the public, because I felt that I couldn't do the best, what I considered to be my best, because I was just hurting too much. And finally I put a little pressure, because I said, I have to get out. I need to heal my body. Okay, so a decision, I guess, was made, and Ivan Koloff was the guy who I thought was a terrific guy to take over for a while. Unfortunately, he didn't take it over for very long. But when I wrestled him, you're asking about that particular night. Mm-hmm. What I thought in my mind, I thought, well, if I lost the match, you're going to hear people boo because he was a villain, they didn't like him. And more or less, that's what I was looking for. But when he came down from the top rope with his knee, came down kind of hard on, not necessarily my neck, but my upper chest, and it was pretty stiff blow that I took there. And so when I didn't hear a beep, it was so quiet, I thought that something had happened to my ears due to that blow. Mm-hmm. But then Arnold Skolin, do you remember Arnold? He came in from the corner. He came in the ring, came over to me, and he said, "Are you okay?" And I heard him perfectly clear. Now I was really confused. I said, "What the heck's going on?" So Arnold helped me up, like, and I'm making my way out of the ring. I couldn't believe what happened. The silence was deafening, as the saying goes. And then what touched me deeply was, as I was walked out of the ring to get back to the dressing room, is I actually saw, not exaggerating, people crying, and a lot of people saying, "Bruno, we still love you, you'll always be our champion." And I thought, oh my God, really hurt these people's feelings. I went to the dressing room instead of being happy, because now I'm going to go home, get time off, or the time to heal. I really felt sad, because I felt like I'd really let these poor people down who had been so supporters of me during that period of time, you know. It was something that I never expected. It was shocking. It was so different that it was just unbelievable, you know. That's a fact. I mean, that's the way it was.
Right, like you said, I mean, you get to a point where you yourself are getting tired and you make this decision, but you don't always consider how it's going to affect other people. From there, yeah, that kind of brings to mind another question. Like today, like wrestling crowds have changed, obviously, over the years. Today, somebody like, say, John Cena, who would fulfill the role that you had been, playing for so long, might face somebody like Bray Wyatt, who would have been, you know, the Ivan Koloff of your day, that would have been booed and hissed at. And now the opposite is happening. Now you see, you know, somebody like Bray Wyatt being cheered and people booing John Cena or something. Like, do you think that's interesting at all? Or do you think that's entertaining at all to you? Or, like, what do you make of the way that people have changed over the years?
I just find it a little, for for me, because of the era that I was in and so forth, I find it kind of strange. I mean, I see a guy like John Cena, which I got to know. I can't tell you that I know him well, but I got to know John Cena. He comes across to me like a very nice guy. He seems to do a lot of charity work.
He does.
Which I respect very much so. And when I see him in the ring, he looks to me like he really gives it his all best that he can. And therefore, it puzzles the heck out of me as to why people, because I've heard that too. I've seen times when maybe 50% would be for him and 50% would be against. And that's something I can't explain and don't understand. I really don't know why the fans are like that. But keep in mind, too, the fans today are different, too. I think they look at wrestling as it's called, strictly entertainment. And they don't. I think they enjoy the great action and everything, but I don't think they take it real seriously, because I remember, for example, and I'm sure you heard of some of these feuds I had with Bill Watts or Spiro Sarion, and most of me with Larry Zbysko. I mean, they had to get guards for these guys to get them in and out of the building because people wanted to kill them. And now it's completely different. I mean, you can have one guy in the ring, and then five, six guys can come in and really pound away, do whatever they do to them, and the fans are just sitting there. It's not day, just be careful that they didn't jump in the ring and do some harm to somebody. So that's completely changed. It's a different kind of fan altogether.
I mean, I can see like the ups and downs of both sides. Like, but there was a level of excitement in your day, like you were saying, of just like, you know, the bad guys really like being bad and like being in danger when they bent the rules, or, you know, when they worked the crowd really and trying to get out of there. They needed police escorts and all that's changed, but it added a whole level of danger and excitement to it.
I've never seen where, in my day I'm talking about, I've never seen where the fans cheered for a so-called villain and booed for a good guy. I never saw in my day. And I was in it for almost a quarter of a century.
It's crazy, because I myself had grown up, you know, watching, you know, Hogan, Savage, people, you know, these were the heroes. People never booed these guys. And I took some time away, and I came back, and I was watching matches where, you know, the heroes were being booed and the villains were being cheered, and like it just blew my mind. I'm like, what happened while I was away?
It's a different time, and everything is different than in wrestling.
Okay, now moving away from that and just keeping things moving, I wanted to ask, who are three guys that you wish you could have wrestled that you never had a chance to get in the ring with, from the past and from the present day, and maybe some rookies that you've seen in, like, say, NXT or something, just a few guys that you've seen, like, through the course of your career, and then like over the 80s, 90s, and then maybe somebody like current that, you know, you would have had the chance to step in the ring with that you might think would have been an interesting matchup.
When you had a long career, as I did, you naturally would like, when you leave the business, you'd like to look back and think of all the so-called top guys, the big guys, the headliners. And you wish, you know, that you would have had the opportunity naturally to look back and to have wrestled them all. Now, I wrestled most of them. And I go all the way back. My first big name guy that I ever wrestled was Gorgeous George. And that stuck with the Yukon Eric, which I used to watch on TV when I came from Europe. I used to see even guys like that I got to wrestle, guys that I used to watch back in that era is what I'm getting at. Gorgeous George, like I said, Killer Kowalski, Daniel Jonathan. I wrestled so many from that era. But I look back as time came to call it a day, where I wish I would have had the opportunity to wrestle other guys that I respected very much, mm-hmm. who I thought were terrific talent. Like I thought Jack Briscoe is a terrific talent. Mm-hmm. I thought both of the Funk Boys, Funk. I think they were both terrific. And you wish that you had had the opportunity to have wrestled with those kind of guys, you know, because that would also make back for great memories of having been in there with all the best of the time. And unfortunately, you know, we had the day of the territory, and so in many cases it was just very, very difficult to... for that all to happen. I feel fortunate because I did wrestle many, many people that I looked upon in the past, and I had great respect and admired them and all that. And but a few regrets that there were a number that I never did get to wrestle. That was during my period. As far as today, I don't even think about it. To be honest with you, I don't think about it because wrestling is my past life, you might say. Yeah. And I don't follow it all that much. I watch, Monday Night Raw here and there for maybe an hour sometimes. It's such a different world that I don't imagine me wrestling some of these guys because the styles were so tremendously different that I just don't try to analyze it and say what I would have done or what kind of a match. I'm being honest with you, I just don't think about it at all. So I really can't tell you names that I wish, if I could today, that I would want to be in there with. Just nobody comes to mind.
Okay, that's fair enough. Now you mentioned catching Raw here and there. Do you have a WWE Network subscription?
My son does, and so I sometimes see it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, let's see. Let me find something else here. Okay. Now, these guys work an insane schedule. Now, they have a 3-hour show every week. They go on the road. There's a pay-per-view every other week now. Do you look at that and think that schedule would have just been completely overwhelming for you, or do you think you could have excelled with that kind of a schedule?
Oh my goodness, I just told you I wrestle 7 days a week, 2 weeks out of the month, and the other 2 weeks I would wrestle 6 days a week, and that wasn't just here in the States. Remember, I toured Japan many, many times. I did Australia. I went all through South America. I went out of Australia, went to Singapore, but places like Hong Kong and the Philippines. I mean, and it was tough because in my day, when you went to Japan or Australia, let's take Australia for an example. But my goodness, now I don't know how long it takes. I haven't been there in a good while. But back then, they didn't have the jumbo jets and all that. And go to Japan or Australia, you're talking about from the time you leave your day, whether it be New York or out of Pittsburgh, till I got there, it would be 36, 38 hours. That would go by. Mm-hmm. You understand? So, think that was tough. And then if Australia brought me in for three, because Vince McMahon Sr. wouldn't run the garden without me in those days when I was on top. So I would leave the day after Madison Square Garden, and then I would come back the day before the garden. So I would go to Japan, and I remember Australia, they'd pick me up at the airport and take me right to the arena, and I would be on 21 straight days where I wrestled every single day.
Wow.
Over there. And then come back, and I needed to go home and come back right to New York, let's say, because I had to be in the garden the following day. And they keep in mind, again, I told you what kind of ranks we had to put
on. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, no, I'm sorry. I think that it was a lot rougher in my day than it is now.
Yeah, there's just more on TV now. Like, you were wrestling just as much or more. The difference is just that there's just happens to be more on television at the modern time, but you were just doing just as much or more. It's just not everybody was seeing it every week.
Well, that's true, yes.
Okay. All right, now let me see. What else do I have here? I've got... Who would you say was your toughest opponent? Like somebody that if you met them outside the ring, you think would have given you like a real run for your money? Like I've seen you against Bruiser Brody, George Steele, Stan Hansen. Is there somebody that you think was just a genuinely tough guy that if, you know, the wrong guy crossed him, it would have been the end of him?
Listen, I'm sorry, there were a lot of tough guys.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As you mentioned, there's no doubt, you know, I respected them all. Bruiser Brody, I wrestled a lot of times. Stan Hansen, mm-hmm. I wrestled him quite a few times.
Yeah.
And you mentioned a third one. I forget. Who was the third guy?
Bruiser Brody or George Steele?
Bruiser Brody. Steele, okay. Well, yeah, but I'll tell you a guy that nobody ever mentions. And I thought he was so good in that ring, and he was a genuine, pretty tough guy. And that was Bobby Duncan. I remember that.
Bobby Duncan, sure. Cowboy Bobby Duncan, yeah.
Yeah. And don't think that guys like Koloff were slouches. Ivan was a tough guy, too. Dolly O'Jonathan, he was like a bear, 6'7", 350 pounds, strong as a horse. And so, well, they were, I would never, Monsoon, remember Monsoon? A lot of people say,
oh,
yeah, he's a big fat guy. Yeah, big fat guy in my foot. He weighed 420 pounds, and he could move. He was a heck of a wrestler, strong. There were a lot of guys that were genuinely very, very tough, and I would never pick one or two of them because that wouldn't be fair. But there were a lot of them that I had the utmost respect for as well, being tough in or out of the ring. They would have been real tough.
Okay, yeah, just amazing guys, amazing performers. Now, moving along, Bob Backlund, he's a guy I'm sure you're familiar with. Now, Bob Backlund famously did not want to have to drop the belt to Hulk Hogan. Now, was there anybody from your past that you had a similar sort of opinion of that you just flat out would not want to have to lose to?
No, let me stop you right there. Not at all. This is almost funny, but I'm probably the only guy, probably, because I don't know the story of every other person who ever had a belt, but I'm probably the only guy that really wanted out my first reign, which was almost 8 years, mm-hmm. and my second reign, which I didn't want no part of, but I finally agreed with McMahon Sr., who told me that if I would come back, that I wouldn't have to wrestle but only a few times a week. Because, you see, between my title reigns, I got a lot of business again because I allowed my body more or less to heal itself. I was working out really, really good. And what I would do is now I was free because I wasn't under contract for anybody. If Sam Mashnick would call me, I'd go to St. Louis. And I'd work a couple matches. And then I'd come home, I'd take off maybe the rest of the week. Or if the Bruiser and I teamed up in the Midwest, I would come in for him for about 3 days, and then I'd take off 7-8 days. If I went to Japan for 2 weeks, I would take off 10 days or 2 weeks. So I had it made. I had all these kind of offers to come to different territory, made my own schedule with different ones, and it was great. And my interest really got rejuvenated in the business. So when Vince McMahon Sr. approached me about coming back. I don't want no part of any belt or anything. I told him, I said, look, whenever you want me to make an appearance, whether it be Boston or any place, I said, you know, I will work it out. I said, but enough with that. And finally, you know, he kind of kept, it was pretty persistent, and he said to me, look, he says, you're wrestling an average of a couple of days a week right now, if you average it out. He says, what we'll do if you come back, you can wrestle the same way. We'll just use you for the major clubs, not the secondary clubs, and you wind up working maybe a couple of days a week, and the rest of the time you're out. He says, I'm asking for 1 year that I can get somebody prepared to take over the territory and to be consistent, you know, to on a regular basis work all the clubs. And with that, I thought, well, that's fair enough, and he kept his word. Vince kept his word, and on my second reign, I was actually working 2 or 3 days a week, which was fine. So I didn't put no pressure. But 1 year went to 2 years went to 3. Then on the 4th year, that's when I broke my neck with Stan Hansen. And naturally, after I, you know, got over that and all, I don't know how much time later it was that I finally said to Vince, come on, Vince, we're supposed to do this for 1 year, it's almost 4. And she says, you know, you got to get somebody, you just got to get somebody. And he did. So what I'm saying is I'm probably one of the only guys who wanted out, because most guys, at least that I've known, you mentioned Bob, they didn't want out. They wanted to keep going with the belt.
Well, that's a good attitude to have, though. It's good to not be too full of yourself. Okay. So let me just see if I have any more questions for you. Do you have any particular match that maybe doesn't get brought up in interviews a lot that stands out to you as just being memorable in some way that maybe wasn't obvious to the audience but just stood out to you in some special way?
Just for example, that whether the audience appreciated him as much as I did, I don't know. One was with Hans Mortier. I remember going hour-long matches with him, and I loved it because he was a good wrestler, and we did a lot, gave me the opportunity to do a lot of wrestling in there. I loved the match I had with Pedro Morales in Shea Stadium because we went an hour, 18 minutes, and wasn't one kick, wasn't one punch.
Wow.
A lot of wrestling, a lot of good action, high spots. I loved those kind of things, but there were a lot of other matches that I loved. But the one guy that never gets mentioned, who I think I had some great matches with, I really do, that I really think about pretty often, as a matter of fact, is Bobby Duncan, that I mentioned a little while ago.
Yeah.
I had some great matches with him. I had a great match with Ray Stevens when I went to California and did a program with him where we wrestled several times, because Ray Stevens was really one of the very best. So, but these are known guys and guys that people ask about all the time. But a guy like Duncan, nobody asks about, but I'm telling you, I had some of my great matches with him. I really enjoyed them.
Okay. All right, let me see. Blading, is that something you ever had in your career? Is that something you didn't want to get into, or is that...
I never wanted to get into that. I didn't like that at all. I really didn't go for that at all. I didn't like that.
Yeah, that could easily go wrong. That's, you know... Now, the UFC, or mixed martial arts, the octagon, if that was something that was around in your day, is that something you think that might have appealed to you, that you might have tried out for or dove into, or do you think that's never something that you would have been interested in?
No, I've been asked that. I've been asked that several times, and I'll tell you. Yeah, I think I would have absolutely been interested. For one thing, keep this in mind, okay, that in my day, we worked an awful lot, like 7 and 6 days a week, as I explained to you a while ago. But in all honesty, our pay came strictly from the arena. If the arenas were full, you know, I was on a percentage, so I picked up a decent payday. If they weren't, you didn't pick up such a decent payday. So in my day, none of us made what you call big money. Not again, don't misunderstand. I was very grateful for what I made, what I was earning, and that because I came from Europe and I went through some very, very bad times over there during the war, especially and after the war. Mm. That's so for me, it was great. Like if you made in the 60s, for example. A lot of the wrestlers were only making 25, 30,000, 40,000. If I'm making 100,000, to me that was I was extremely grateful. But of course, when we move ahead and look at what they were making later, much later, you're talking about a lot of guys who are making millions of dollars per year. So, you know, the money situation today, from what I hear anyway, because I don't know any, what guys are really make or anything, but from what I've heard, they're making the millions, and that's pretty darn phenomenal.
Yeah.
But, like I said, in my day, it wasn't like that. But when I hear about the martial arts that you spoke of, I don't know what it would have been like back then as far as finances. But from what I hear, again, from what I hear, because I don't know nothing for a fact, that some of these guys make like hundreds of thousands of dollars of the match.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, that's what, I think that would have inspired me because
yeah.
I had some wrestling background, not bragging, but I was very, very strong in my day. I knew a little bit of submission wrestling. I wasn't an expert in it. I had done a little bit of boxing, not a lot. But if you're going to get into something like that, you naturally would have trained very hard to get better at all these things. You know what I mean? So I don't know how good or bad I might have been at it, but I certainly would have liked it and would have given it a shot because, you see, I wasn't interested in, for example, in wrestling for 25 years or whatever. I had to because in order, I'm not a college graduate. I came from the old country, like I said. And, mm-hmm. and so what did I have to fall back to if I got out and wasn't financially prepared to get out? I would have had to get a job. And what kind of job would be out there for me? Back to construction work? And when you beat up your body the way we did, I don't think that would have been a good thing for me. So I had to stay in a long time. I tried to save and invest properly. Made some mistakes, but I did some good things as well. So that by the time I got out, I gave my kids the opportunity for an education. And my wife and I, we were left in a situation to where we didn't have money to burn, but we could live a comfortable life. And what more than that does one really need? So I feel very fortunate. But to answer your question, because I didn't want a long, long career like I had. If I could have shortened it by making money, more money, I would have achieved what I wanted to achieve. I absolutely would have got into it.
Okay. All right. Okay. Good. Okay. So I don't have too much more, but Sal, your agent, he mentioned your book that you had some time ago, and the book deal went kind of sour, and how he is rewriting the book for you for a re-release. Do you want to tell us something about that?
Well, the book never went sour. It just that it never had the opportunity to see what it could do.
Yeah.
Because when we first did this book, I wasn't interested at all at the time, but a friend of mine said that these were friends of his, that they were great guys, and they were right here from Pittsburgh, and I knew nothing about that, publishers, and I knew nothing, really. So I finally, they said, well, if they're willing to work with you whenever you have the spare time. And I said, well, all right, I'll finally get there. So I went, and we did the book, we did the story and all that. But then we found out after they did that, they printed 10,000 copies, that there really had no connections, nothing outside of Pittsburgh. Mm. They just like the local stores here, bookstores, did some radio advertising. And then, you know, it took a while, but when those books went, they wanted to do a reprint. And I said, no. I said, I bet you people said that you have connection to take this book and take it nationwide. I said, so you can't do that. You haven't done that. So I said, no, I'm not interested. So that was the end of that. Saw the book and everything, and he thought it was great. He felt that there was so much that should have been, you know, that should be in there that wasn't in there, okay? First, this is remember that the first book we did was in 1991. So it's been a long time. And Snell came up with the idea that there's so many things that have happened since, and things that went on before that we didn't write about. And so he felt that we should redo this thing, book, and really make it like a new book. Not that you don't have some real stuff. For example, my period in the old country and what we went through during the war and what it was like then when we first came to America. That will be there because that was extremely, somebody who's interested would be very interesting read. So we have all that, but we have a lot more stuff, stories that were never put into the first book. And so Sal's been working on it with some other people, and he's really more or less brought the book up to date.
Okay. Now, how does an immigrant come over and get discovered and become the living legend? I mean, how did you get to meet Vince McMahon Sr.? How does that even happen?
The way it happened was that I was, you know, here in Pittsburgh, of course. Not only was I was doing some amateur wrestling and that, but I was also competing in weightlifting. And they had a contest in Oklahoma City. I could never compete in a lot of places because I had no sponsors and I couldn't afford to travel around the country on my own. I was working as an apprentice barman for making $2 an hour. I couldn't afford anything. But where I trained, YMCA, they said they'd sponsor me to this Oklahoma meet. Anyway, long story, I went there and I won the contest. And when I came home, we had a guy named Bob Prince, who was the voice of the Pittsburgh Pirates. And he had his own television show on CBS, KDKA here in Pittsburgh. And when he saw that there was a little write-up, nothing big, that I had won the North American Weightlifting Championship, he invited me on his show because he used to come up to the Y where I trained, not to work out or anything. He used to like to go to what they call the health club, where they would go out there, take a massage, and take some steam and stuff like that, you know. The weightlifting and basketball, swimming, they were the lower level of the building. And so he invited me on his show to talk about this this contest. So when I went on his show and we talked about, you know, the contest in Oklahoma City, and then he asked me, he said, "Bruce, do you still wrestle? Do you still work out at Benton?" And I said, "Yeah, I still go there." I said, "Well, I'm still doing it." Rudy Miller, who represented Capital Wrestling, which later became the Worldwide Wrestling Federation, was in Pittsburgh because he used to come in a day before because they used to do studio wrestling here on a channel called Channel 11, which was an NBC affiliate. And he happened to be watching that night because he'd come in, I guess, that afternoon. I don't know when, but at night he was in his hotel room and he watched. And he happened to click into the station, so he found that one. And when he saw me on there and they were talking about wrestling, and we were talking about wrestling and weightlifting, he went to the studio the next day and he asked people there, said, "Does anybody know this kid named Bruno Sammartino?" And one of the kids that I went to high school with, his name was John Cartonis, he said, "Yeah, we live in the same street in Oakland section of the city." Anyway, he says, "Could you ask him if he would come here next week when I come back in town? I'd like to speak to him." So the following, so John Tortoni contacted me during the week one day, and he told me about it. So that Saturday, I went to the studio for studio wrestling, and I met Rudy Miller. He looked me over. I was 270 pounds at the time, and he seemed very impressed at my physical appearance. And he says, "I'd like to bring you to Washington, D.C., and have some people meet you." Is it because I think that you could probably have a future in wrestling? So he flew me to Washington, and that's when I met Vince and Toots McMahon. The first time they took me to an arena, they didn't say anything to me about anything. They just had a couple of pros, and they asked me to just go in there. They wanted to see what I could do. Well, naturally, I didn't know nothing, so I did the kind of wrestling that I knew, that I had trained with and so forth. And evidently, they were kind of impressed because they said to me afterwards, they said, "You know, if you could come over for about a month